Thank you. It could have been a lot of these guys, but there can only be one MVP. And this year's MVP is a player who didn't start in a single game until these finals. This year's Bill Russell MVP, Andre Iguodala.
Commissioner just mentioned it, 758 straight games in your career you started. In what way did your sacrifice of coming off the bench embody the spirit of this entire group?
We got a team full of believers. We all go to chapel before every game. We all believe, and we all say God has a way for you, a purpose for you. This is my purpose, and I accepted it, and I got great teammates. Steph, I want to be just like Steph when I grow up. Just a God-fearing man, great guy.
There's a set of young eyes on you right here. Can you describe what it's like to hold that, be a champion, and have your son standing right here?
Man, it's so much. This is my man, my boo-boo London at home. Oh, man, this is great. We gonna remember this for a long time.
Congratulations, Andre.
So being a Southern California native and a Los Angeles Laker fan since 1973, I never imagined in a million years that I would show a Warriors clip in a sermon. But I was compelled by what that video showed. Did you catch it? Andre had been a star, and he had been a starter for 758 straight games until this prior season with the Warriors. His coach understood that the Warriors would be a better team if Andre came off the bench. So he came off the bench all year. The Warriors become the NBA champions, and Andre receives the most valuable player trophy of the finals coming off the bench up until those finals games. It's an incredible story of teamwork that led to success. We see here that it showed a great team has the same goals. They follow the same leader. They love their teammates and think more of their teammates than themselves. They pay the price to accomplish the task. And sadly for me, they did the exact opposite of what my Lakers did this year and accomplished the opposite result. They actually won games. And it was fun to watch how piece by piece they built this team and are now celebrating its success. But we're reminded today as we continue our series in Nehemiah titled Rebuilding Your Broken World that there are more important things than NBA teams that need to be rebuilt in life. And Brian reminded us of that so beautifully today. We learned that God is in the business of rebuilding broken worlds. In chapter 1, we were challenged to listen to God and to identify something in our world that was broken. For some of us, God brought to mind something wrong in our inner world. Maybe it was a sin, some conflict, some fear. And for others of us, God brought to mind something in our outer world, some injustice, some glaring need that God wouldn't allow us to ignore without dealing with it. We see, as it unfolds in Nehemiah, how God rebuilds broken worlds. We were impressed with Nehemiah's passion for the injustices he saw in his outer world. His people's beloved city of Jerusalem was left unprotected, her walls rubble, her people were mocking his God. And we saw Nehemiah pray. He prayed for 4 months. We saw that Nehemiah not only prayed, but as he prayed, he also planned. And we saw him take advantage of the opportunities that his boss, the Persian king Artaxerxes, provided him. So he took a huge step of faith and he went to that king and he asked for help, for the resources. And then we see in chapter 2, verse 8, he took no personal credit. He said, because the gracious hand of God is upon me, the king granted my requests. So in the latter part of chapter 2, we see that Nehemiah arrives in Jerusalem and he inspects the scope of the project. He saw the broken down walls. He saw the burned gates that had been destroyed. And in my mind, what I see here is this developing. He goes from passion. God had disturbed him about something, to prayer. And then to planning. And then to people. That there's no rebuilding of broken worlds without other people in our lives. And this principle rises out of Nehemiah chapter 3. God raises up good leaders to mobilize people to rebuild a broken world. And I love Nehemiah 2:18. Nehemiah says, I told them about the gracious hand of my God on me and what the king had said to me. And they replied, let's start rebuilding. So they began the good work. Rebuilding broken worlds requires that we either lead well or we allow ourselves to be led well. Either way, good leadership is needed to rebuild broken worlds. As we look at Nehemiah chapter 3, some of us might be tempted to just kind of pass over that. The entire chapter, 32 verses, is a list of names, most too difficult to pronounce, and information that appears when you start reading it to become quite redundant. But as we dig deeper, we find that the chapter details a case study for project management. I want us to look at a simple map that hopefully this will help make more sense of that. Because good leaders first organize their project. So let's put the map up there. This is a map, just a rudimentary map of Nehemiah's Jerusalem. If we start at the north, we start at the top, we see something called the Sheep Gate. And if you move counterclockwise, you'll see a wall connecting then to the Fish Gate and a wall connecting to the Old Gate and then the long western wall there to the Valley Gate. And then down to the south, you see the Dung Gate, and then it turns a corner and goes up the east side, the Fountain Gate, and then the Water Gate and the Horse Gate on the east side, the East Gate, and the Inspection Gate. 10 gates connected by walls that connect them all. All of these are mentioned in Nehemiah chapter 3. But the most striking thing we see in his project management is that he divides this job, this huge job, into smaller, more manageable sections. For what appears to be an impossible task, Nehemiah makes possible. Now, an obvious question I was looking at this, well, how many lineal feet of wall are they actually rebuilding? We don't exactly know, but we do know it was at a minimum of 2 miles of wall going all the way around the perimeter, with 10 gates that needed to be rebuilt within that 2 miles. So after Nehemiah organizes the project, he then organizes the people into teams and he assigns each team to a different part of the wall. So good leaders not only organize their project, but they also organize their people. What Nehemiah did here is he delegated authority. That word delegate doesn't appear in chapter 3, but it's obvious that that's what happened. In chapter 3, I counted 44 separate groups or teams of people assigned to a separate portion of the wall. Beginning in verse 1, Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the Sheep Gate. They dedicated it and set its doors in place, building as far as the Tower of the Hundred, which they dedicated, and as far as the Tower of Hananel. So I don't think it was by accident that Nehemiah started at the far north of the wall. There's two reasons for that. The north side is actually the most vulnerable. If you've ever been over to Jerusalem and seen it from the west, from the east, from the south, there's steep inclines. It would be very difficult for attackers to come up those steep inclines and come up and invade Jerusalem. But the north was very flat. And so that was the most vulnerable area. And David knew that, and that's why when he designed the city, he put towers on the north section to protect from invading armies. And that's why you see the two towers. And in Jesus' day, the Romans saw that too. As they were defending Jerusalem, they built towers, and they were called the Antonia Fortress. It's also significant that he started with the priests. This was the closest wall to the actual temple. That's why the sheep gate was up there. It was there where the animals were brought in for sacrifice during Passover. And the sheep gate here is mentioned first. The idea here is that it means put God first in the project. So the priests, which I think is really cool, they didn't just sit on the sidelines and supervise. You know, they girded up their tunics and they got down and they did the work. Even the high priest, Eliashib, was working. Now understand what that high priest looked like. He wore an ephod, which was an apron, and there was a panel on the front of him that had 12 large different jewels, which represented the 12 tribes of Israel. And then he had a blue turban hat, and on the front of that turban was a gold plate, and on that gold plate it said, "Holiness unto Yahweh." He had a really special outfit, so he's out there also picking up rubble and laying brick. I can imagine he had quite a dry cleaning bill at the end of the project. Goes on in verse 2 through 5. The men of Jericho built the adjoining section, and Zachar, son of Imri, built next to them. The fish gate was rebuilt by the sons of Hasenaah. And they laid its beams and put its doors and bolts and bars in place. Miramath, son of Uriah, son of Hakaz, repaired the next section. And next to him, Meshulam, son of Berechiah, the son of Mishezabel, made repairs. And next to him, Zadok, son of Baanah, also made repairs. And the next section was repaired by the men of Tekoa, but their nobles would not put their shoulders to the work under their supervisors. So as we see in verse 1, with a sheep gate, it illustrates a priority. What we see in verses 2 through 5 is an illustration of unity. It's interesting that if you were to highlight every time phrases throughout this chapter, such as next to him, or next to them, or after him, or after them. If you count up how many times those phrases were used, I counted 28 times in the chapter those phrases are used. And this kind of unity doesn't just happen. It never just happens. It's a result of, for Nehemiah, passion and prayer and planning. And then he got everyone involved side by side in the project. Well, not everyone. You see in verse 5, the men of Tekoa worked their portion of the wall, but their nobles would not put their shoulders to the work under their supervisors. Tekoa was a town about 11 miles from Jerusalem. So these working men commuted to the job site, and really their nobles, their leaders called in sick. And that phrase, shoulders to the work, it suggests that it was pride more than anything that kept them from pitching in. They didn't want to submit themselves. They were too important to let their hands get dirty. But in reality, these nobles were missing out on one of the greatest privileges a believer can ever have. They were too prideful to help rebuild a broken world. They were too prideful to experience the blessings of being involved in kingdom work. They were too prideful to put God first. And Nehemiah mentions it. And we see on in verse 8. Uzziel, son of Harhaiah, one of the goldsmiths, repaired the next section. And Hananiah, one of the perfume makers, made repairs next to that. They restored Jerusalem as far as the broad wall along the west side. So we see priority, and we see unity, and now we see a diversity. Notice, he used all kinds of people. He didn't just grab, you know, the big arm, hard hat union guys on Harleys. He grabbed jewelers and perfumers to work on the wall. I'm thinking of their work and their skills, and I'm thinking that was probably the most dazzling and sparkling part of the wall, and probably smelled the best too as well. I'm looking at it, I'm thinking, you know, if I was Nehemiah, I'd have done it differently. I'd have put the perfumer down at the bottom at the dung gate to see what he could do with that. So as we dig deeper, We see good leaders that mobilize people to rebuild broken worlds, not only organize their project, not only organize their people, they also, and we can't miss this, they take care of their people. Good leaders take care of their people. And what we see from Nehemiah is he knows them. He knows them. He got to know them. Shalom, son of Halahesh, verse 12, ruler of a half district of Jerusalem, repaired the next section with the help of his daughters. He mentions these families by name and even notices the kids that are part of this big project. A coordinated effort, 44 teams, 44 sections of work, every name recorded in his journal, which is basically a work log of chapter 3, because Nehemiah saw them as special. Can you imagine what it must have felt like to them to know that Nehemiah recorded their name, that they were involved in a project Nehemiah saw that was only possible because of what God had done, and he saw that everyone on the team was valued and that God brought them together because God loved them and wanted to use them. So Nehemiah, chapter 3, a record of everyone's contribution, right? Well, there's one name missing. You know who that one name was? Who's not on the list? Nehemiah. He doesn't mention himself. You know, well, why not? He was as active as anybody, more so probably than anybody. But when it came to giving credit, his credit was about giving it to others and giving it to God. And what a contrast to what our world and how our world sees things. And that's what makes this so fresh. If you recall, 140 years before Nehemiah got into Jerusalem and did this project, the Babylonian king, Nebuchadnezzar, well, he had conquered Jerusalem, and he's standing on his palace roof in Babylon, and he looks out over his city, and it's recorded in Daniel 4:30. He says, "Is not this the great Babylon I have built as the royal residence? By my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty." What a contrast. Nehemiah gave credit to others and he gave glory to God. Nebuchadnezzar took glory for himself, and we see he was judged for that as well. As we continue to dig deeper and look at this and continue to read, we see that he knew his teammates here in even deeper ways. He knew where they lived, and he assigned them to work by their own homes. Verses 28 through 30. Above the horse gate, the priests made repairs, each in front of his own house. Next to them, Zadok, son of Immer, made repairs opposite his house. And next to him, Shemaiah, son of Shechaniah, the guard at the east gate, made repairs. And next to him, Hananiah, son of Shelemiah, and Hanun, the sixth son of Zaloph, repaired another section. And opposite to them, Meshulam, son of Berechiah, made repairs opposite his living quarters. You think, so to have them work by their own homes, to have them work in their own neighborhoods, you step back and look at it, that was a brilliant strategy. Because they got personally involved and they cared deeply about that particular part of the city. It cut down on the commute, that's for sure, but also in case there was an attack, they wouldn't be tempted to leave their assignment and go to their own homes, but they would stay right where they were and continue to work and protect their homes and their families. So he knew them, and then from that, he also went deeper and he made a point to encourage them. Verse 20 is a great example of that. Next to him, Baruch, son of Zabai, zealously repaired another section from the angle to the entrance of the house of Eliashib, the high priest. It's easy to miss when you read through this little statement that's tucked away in these whole 32 verses of names. It's one name, Zabai, and one word, zealously. And Nehemiah evidently believed this man deserves special attention. I mean, we don't know why, what that zealousness looked like. Maybe he worked overtime for nothing. Maybe he worked faster. Maybe he worked harder. Maybe he skipped his coffee breaks. We don't know. But we do know that it didn't go unnoticed by Nehemiah, and it's in God's Word. And here we are thousands of years later talking about how Nehemiah encouraged people. And then there's another little statement. Down by the water gate where the temple servants worked, we read about the men of Tekoa again. Verse 27. Next to them, the men of Tekoa repaired another section from the great projecting tower to the wall of Ophel. So the men of Tekoa, remember back in verse 5, they must have finished their section, but they didn't punch out. They went from, you know, here they are, they're coming from out of town. But instead of going back, they go the extra mile while their nobles stayed back and pouted back in their town. They sacrificed, really sacrificed for the team, and Nehemiah calls them out. So, as I step back and I look at, for example, a Sunday morning at CPC, I think it's important because I don't think we always connect the dots, and we need to. Sunday morning at CPC is an example of God at work. God at work through people who are working different sections of the CPC wall with passion, with prayer, with planning, and then with action, with people. So our passion is to make and mature more followers of Jesus Christ. And we believe that we can see this happen if we make sure our walls are built up and our gates are functioning, so it is as easy as possible for any of us to come and worship. So it is as easy as possible for any of us to come and learn about how much God loves us. So it's as easy as possible for us to understand and embrace what God did for us, the sacrifice He made in sacrificing His Son, Jesus Christ, who willingly gave up His life on the cross, took upon ourselves the sin and condemnation that we deserved. He took that on Himself, and then in turn gave us forgiveness and new life in Him. To have our walls and our gates in place so it is easy as possible, so that we might know the hope that comes through a real relationship with God who truly rebuilds broken lives. If we don't take anything else from this message, rebuilding broken worlds, it's a team sport. We need each other. And I think of several teams that are actively involved in repairing and building with zeal around this place on a Sunday morning. I see in one section, I see a worship team. And next to them, adjoining them, I see a tech team, a sound team. And next to them, I see an usher team. And in that section next to them, I see a communion serving team. And then down front, I see next to them a prayer team. And then in some outer sections of the wall, I see a greeter team. I see a welcome team. I see a Sunday worker team. I see a coffee team. And I see a parking team. And so that we don't have to worry about where our children are and that they're being taken care of, I want you to know that way out yonder, we see a CPC kids team working the wall with passion. And we see a student ministries team doing the same thing. And I think it's important that we appreciate these teams and that we thank God for these teams. Right now, I'd love to, with just a round of applause, all of these teams. What I'm learning is I need you alongside me to rebuild broken worlds. Whether it's something in my inner world that's broken or some passion I have out there for an injustice. And you need me alongside you to rebuild your broken world. As the Apostle Paul said in Romans chapter 12, verse 5, so in Christ, we who are many form one body, and each member belongs to all the others. I've been involved in some intense ministries over the years, and I've learned some hard lessons about how important it is to encourage teammates in their places in the wall. Not only do we need each other, but we're also better when we're together. Around Labor Day on the calendar year, where I served before coming to CPC, the church that I had there was in Northwest Wisconsin. And around Labor Day, changes would start to happen. The days would get shorter. Obviously, you could just see it. It just seemed like it was just happening rapidly. And the nights would get cooler. And the maples would start turning color. And the geese would start to gather in this cornfield. I looked out my office window. I had a cornfield. And I could see these geese gathering in the fall as they began their staging for their trip south of about 3,000 miles. That we're going to make together on this journey. So after that, we'd start to see these V's of geese airborne. And you'd stop and you'd look and you'd listen and you'd hear honking. And you'd hear and you'd see flapping. And you'd see them flying in that general southern direction. There's a lot we can learn from the goose. There are several things that happen when geese take this long journey together. First, when you hear that honking, you need to know that that honking isn't random. The geese at the rear of the V formation are honking with a purpose. They honk to encourage those in front of them to keep up the speed and to keep on keeping on. Now, I don't know about you, but I need people on my journey with me to honk at me to keep me focused. We need each other. We need others to honk at us, to avoid discouragement, to avoid distraction from the work at hand, to be a part of rebuilding a broken world. We need honkers around us. The Bible speaks about the positives of honking. Hebrews chapter 10, verses 24 through 25, the writer says this, "And let us consider how we may spur on one another." In other words, honk one another on toward love and good deeds, not giving up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching. Some of us really have the spiritual gift of honking. You know, use that gift. Get honkers in your life. Did you know that this wall was built in only 52 days? It was an incredible project. And you'll see, we'll see some opposition later on as we continue. I think it just took these guys off guard as to how fast this thing was completed. There must have been some real gifted honkers on Nehemiah's project. So then also, if you look at these geese in flight, you'll see and hear flapping. Now, flappers help the team when they're right next to one another. If I have a flapper next to me, it helps me. Scientists discovered that as each bird flaps its wings, it creates an uplift for the bird immediately following. So by flying in a V formation, the whole flock adds, now get this, the whole flock adds at least 71% greater flying range than if each bird were flying on its own. That means that if one bird can fly 100 miles alone, a flock in the V formation can fly 171 miles and expend the same amount of energy. We need each other. We need others around us to flap next to us. King Solomon in Ecclesiastes 4, 9 and 10 says this, "Two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. If either of them falls down, one can help the other up. But pity anyone who falls and has no one to help them up. I have been blessed to have flappers in my life that have built me up to help rebuild the broken worlds that God has called me to be involved in." And some of you here have flapping power that is not being utilized to help the rest of the team. Ask God to open your hearts to share those resources so you can see how far God will take you and take this team, whatever team He's drawing you to make a difference. Well, other times, while on the journey, geese will get sick, or they'll be wounded. Maybe they're shot at by hunters, and they must drop out of formation. So when a goose falls out of formation, two other geese will fall out of formation as well and follow him or her down to help protect that wounded goose. And they stay there until the goose is either able to fly away or the goose dies before they launch out and try to catch up to their flock or join up with another flock. We need others to fall out of formation to help us. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 12:26, "If one part suffers, every part suffers with it. If one part is honored, every part rejoices with it." When one part is hurting, may we never forget, we are the church, and we are a contrast to the world. The church, by being different, doesn't shoot their wounded. When they fall out of formation, we help. We don't just wave goodbye. Sometimes suffering alongside is the best thing we can do by bearing someone else's burdens to restore their broken world. I think of our prayer team that makes it easy for ministry to happen here. That every service, some of us in our church family come down front because we've fallen out of formation. We are wounded, we're hurting, we're sick. And I love watching this prayer team work because they fall out of formation and they come down and they meet people where they are and they help and they protect. It's a great visual about how we are in this Christian life, not to do it alone, we're to do it together. So many of us in this Nehemiah series, we've identified what's broken in our world. God has disturbed us about something, saying, you can't ignore this. You've got to do something about this. And then He gives us the passion to see something change. And then we're praying and then we're planning. And now we must embrace, as it's brought out in chapter 3, we must embrace the fact that if our world is broken, it will not be rebuilt alone. We need others alongside us for that journey. And it's right to ask this morning, what is our next step? May God give each of us, I don't know if I could word it any differently than this, the good sense of a goose, in order to understand that we are better together and that rebuilding your broken world is not about I or me, it is about us and we. So we're going to conclude today a little differently, and I'd like everyone to stand up right now as the worship team will come out to lead us in a final song. And you remember the people around you that you greeted on the front end of the service. I want you to turn to one or more of those people around you, and I want you to say this to them. I want you to say, "I need you alongside me." Go ahead and do that right now. All right. And I want you to do one more thing. I want you now to turn to those same people and I want you to say this: you need me alongside you. Go ahead.